intervene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We're delighted to call our third case, our third insurance case today. 03-AP-3258, Daniel J.R. LeCount versus General Casualty. R. George Burnett representing James Wingfield et al. You may proceed, counsel.
May it please the court, I'm George Burnett. I represent the petitioner in this case. This case presents the very narrow issue of whether 632.32 sub 3 sub A compels independent policy limits for the named insured under a policy and a permissive user. In preparing for this argument today, it occurred to me that after you state that issue, that the law has a way of draining the human tragedy behind a case from it. It sterilizes a case. And it struck me that the contrast between how this case began and how this case ends is striking. This case, as the court is no doubt aware, began when a careless teenager drove her car into the path of another vehicle. That accident killed James Wingfield, left his three children orphaned, his wife a widow, and it left a young passenger in the Langer vehicle with brain damage that will last forever. This case ends in a Gus courtroom with two lawyers talking about what a dozen words in an obscure insurance statute really mean. I say obscure not because 632.32.3A is unimportant, but because I suspect it's largely unknown to most of the citizens in this state. That statute is, in fact, part of an exceedingly important statute in this state, a statute that's been in place for a very long period of time. The Wisconsin legislature passed the omnibus statute to protect Wisconsin policyholders and the catastrophically injured. It passed that statute to protect the very people who stand before this court today. So what do these two dozen words that are at the center of this case say, and what do they mean? Sub 3A says, except as provided in sub 5, every policy subject to this section issued to an owner shall provide that coverage provided to the named insured applies in the same manner and under the same provisions to any person using any motor vehicle described in the policy, and it continues that to require that it occur for a legitimate use. In this case, the plaintiff says that those words mean that the named insured was guaranteed $500,000 in policy coverage, and that the permissive user, Courtney Langer, was guaranteed an identical separate coverage of $500,000. General Casualty, the company that issued and wrote this policy, says that sub 3A of the statute means the same thing as sub 3B. Sub 3B says coverage extends to any person legally responsible for the use of the motor vehicle. The question then focuses on the different words the legislature used when it passed this statute. The legislature passed the two parts of this statute using very different words, and it did that for a reason. The court commonly resorts to a common dictionary to determine what those words mean, and I would suggest that there are two words that are especially important here. The first is the word apply, the second is the word extend. This court has already held in Folkman that the word extend means that Those separately insured under the policy must share policy limits. And indeed, that's consistent with a common dictionary definition of the term, extend, which means to make available, provide, in the American Heritage Dictionary, the fourth edition. The example they use is extend credit to qualified purchasers.
So you think that this would not overrule, but would simply extend Volkman? Is that what your argument is? I think that as I look at Volkman, and maybe I'm correct, it seemed to say that the statute did not extend the policy limit to both the tortfeasor and to the person here, the father, under vicarious liability. You seem to be saying that that was read not incorrectly, but you could read it differently.
Yeah, I wouldn't read Volkman for guidance on this case at all, and the reason for that is Volkman dealt with 3B of the statute. This case is brought before the court on the basis of 3A. Volkman was very careful in confining its holding to 3B. The court in Volkman did that in, if I remember it right, paragraphs 62 through about 67. And it mentioned 3B a number of times in that discussion. Volkman was a 39-page, 75-paragraph decision, and it analyzed Section 3A.
What I was reading, and I'm just going to quote this, in cases of vicarious liability, the omnibus statute does not extend policy limit protection to both the tortfeasor and the persons vicariously liable for the tortfeasor's wrongdoing. I hope I haven't misquoted that. I have that in my notes here, but it seemed to me it would cover this.
In paragraph 63, the court framed the issue as, under the rule in Miller and Iaquinta, limitation on liability conflicts with Section 632.32(3)(b) when both a named insured and additional insured that is legally responsible for the use of the motor vehicle are each actively negligent.
Counsel, I think he was reading the first sentence of paragraph 64, except he didn't have in reference to the...
No, I had no reference. I was just... What I was trying to...
It was
to
verbatim, determine. Except yeah. didn't Is have anything...
You're distinguishing and just saying Volkman does not...
In paragraph 64, it says, in cases of vicarious liability, 3B does not extend policy limits protection to both the tortfeasor and the person or persons vicariously liable. So my position is that sure. Volkman is talking about a different part of this statute.
And why should we interpret 3A differently than 3B in regard to coverage?
There's about five different reasons. The first is centered in the language of the statute itself. I was just reciting the dictionary definition of the term extend. If we continue and cite the dictionary definition of the term apply means to put to or adapt for a special use. The example the same dictionary gives is applies her money to her mortgage. So the first reason is that the legislature purposely used different words. They must mean something else. Otherwise, the legislature would have drafted 3A to say coverage provided to this named insured extends in the same manner and under the same provision to any person using the vehicle. The second reason behind that is that 3A discusses the rights of two individual people. It discusses the rights of the named insured, and it discusses the rights of permissive users. The rights of permissive users are measured by the rights of named insureds. That can only mean something if the named insured has something that has a right that serves as a foundation, a basis, a bulwark for this. The third reason is that the court this Court has long said that the legislature does not pass superfluous statutes. And I submit to you that if 3A and 3B mean the same thing, that a permissive user has to share policy limits with a named insured under 3B, then there's no reason to have 3A at all. The reason for that is 3B says coverage extends to any person legally responsible for the motor vehicle. Well, the permissive user, the driver, who is hailed into court and called into account for their negligence, is always legally responsible for the use of the vehicle.
If I lent my adult son my car, his car was broken, so I said he could use mine, and he gets in an accident, are you saying I am legally responsible for Matthew's negligence?
No.
Well, isn't that what 3A talks about when it talks about any person? Doesn't that include an adult person that you lend your car to for whom you have no legal responsibility anymore for their acts?
No, 3A defines insurance coverage.
Right.
Not liability.
Okay, but it extends coverage to any person using any motor vehicle. And I was trying to understand your argument about saying that if this isn't some distinguishing feature over 3B, then it's a superfluous statute. And I think maybe its application may include the folks in 3B, but maybe it includes a lot of other people too.
I think 3B is broader than 3A, which is why...
Why do you think it's broader?
Because the words legally responsible are much broader than the words applies in the same manner and in the same provisions. I can't think of an example, if General Casualty's interpretation of 3A is correct, where 3B would apply when 3A would apply but 3B wouldn't. You know, there's two, I think, real-world examples that show how these two statutes might interrelate. One is actually evident in the Lansinger case, which the Court of Appeals decided a number of years ago. In Lansinger, there was a claim brought under 3B that said an employer, employee, master, servant were entitled to separate policy limits. That would be
something. Was that a negligent entrustment case? I forget what the cause of action was against the...
No, that was purely vicarious liability in Lansinger.
As master, servant, wasn't it?
As was Mills. So there was no active negligence at all there. The 3A wouldn't cover Lansinger because you have a master and a servant involved. But 3B
wouldn't cover the master.
Pardon?
3A wouldn't cover the master.
Wouldn't cover the master.
Would cover the servant.
Would cover the servant.
Okay. And B covers the master.
B covers the master.
Also the servant.
Pardon?
Also the servant.
It would also cover the servant. And that's qualified by the notion that the servant's not driving the master's car. If the master's the named insured, then you have an identical situation under 3A, and there would be coverage for both. I'm not sure if that answered your question, Justice Rogensack, or not.
No, I'm still confused, but you go ahead. It'll get sorted out, hopefully, as it goes on.
Your point is that they are not totally overlapping.
They're not totally.
They may overlap in any particular situation, but you gave us an example where they do not overlap. Therefore, you have two different provisions. And you're saying that because they can extend to two different people, that the language is significant, and therefore they need not be interpreted the same terms of vicarious liability.
That's right. And the additional point that if all 3A does is it gives some umbrella of insurance protection to a permissive user, and that permissive user must share limits, there's no reason to have 3A at all. because 3B covers that person every single time.
I don't see, in my example that I gave you of my son, how is he covered under 3B?
Your son is covered under 3A
right.
as a permissive user. Your son is also covered under 3B because he's a person legally responsible for the use of the vehicle. A driver is always legally responsible.
Well, I see what you're saying. Okay, thank you. That, I understand now what your argument was.
Okay,
that's
thank you.
The point I missed. Thank you.
So the whole point is that General Casualty's proposed interpretation makes 3A unnecessary, superfluous, and the court has many, many cases that says it will not read statutes that way. The next reason is perhaps the most important one, and that is that interpreting a statute that is not clear on its face, the court always looks to the underlying purpose behind the statute. And this court's case law is very, very clear in the Forion case, F-O-R-Y-A-N, at 27 with second, specifically at page 141, that the omnibus statute is always interpreted when there are doubts about it to expand insurance coverage, protect policyholders, and compensate accident victims. The coverage that interpretation that General Casualty proposes here constricts insurance coverage, it lessens the protection for policyholders, and it leaves accident victims less than fully compensated.
But, Counselor, if we buy your argument, then they're going to receive twice the amount of insurance that they chose to purchase. So what you do is you give them a split payment policy, and the insurance company will have to pay out twice on $500,000 instead of the once that the debt page shows and the clear language of the statute, I mean of the policy shows.
Actually, that's been the law in certain situations for about 20 years or longer. Miller versus Amundsen is a perfect example of that. In that particular case, you had a mother and a grandmother driving a pickup truck with a child in the back. Mom was driving, grandma was watching the child. The child tumbled out of the pickup truck. Claim was brought against both mother and grandmother, claiming separate policy limits for each. And insurance company invoked the same limit of liability clause that we're talking about today.
But wasn't there a different type of negligence? Maybe there was, and I'm just asking, whether there was active or inactive, passive. Here it seems that we're talking about vicarious, which is a pass-through situation. In other words, he sponsored her license, and therefore, and he had a policy that, as Justice Robinsack indicated, had a $500,000 top, so to speak. And what was the negligence of, was there negligence in the case you're talking about?
There was active negligence on the part of both.
Yeah. I guess that was my question. Here, do you think that there's active negligence on the part of the
sponsor? No.
No.
No, I don't.
So isn't that a different situation?
It is a different situation, but not meaningfully different for this reason. And this really comes down to the judicial philosophy the court intends to apply to this case. This is a case about statutory interpretation, about what the words in a statute mean. And when you read 632.32.3a, you find no distinction between actively negligent and vicariously liable people. That has been a distinction engrafted purely by the fiat of the Court of Appeals. And if you engage in the legal archaeology, which really is necessary to explore that, what you will find is there is no basis in Miller, the case that supposedly began all this, for that kind of a distinction. And you'll find that that distinction was born in a single sentence in the Lansinger case as a way to distinguish Miller. Miller was a 3A case, Lansinger was a 3B case, and Miller and Lansinger recognized that. And Lansinger came first, Mills came second. Mills was a sponsorship case. Allegation, again, under 3B, not 3A, but 3B, was that the sponsor and the permissive user were entitled to separate policy limits, that coverage should extend under 3B. And what Mills said was, we are bound by Lansinger. There is no principled way to distinguish a master servant from a sponsorship situation. But we have serious reservations about Lansinger, and we have serious reservations about its interrelationship with a case called Smith versus National Indemnity, and we urge the court to reexamine it. So for a long time, this distinction between vicariously liable and actively negligent policyholders, insureds, has been a dubious one, and the Court of Appeals recognized that.
Mr. Burnett, let me ask you, because I want to make sure I understand all the ramifications of your argument. What was the theory of liability? I understand the theory of liability for Courtney was that she was driving.
That's right.
And caused the accident. What was the theory of liability for Joseph Langer?
Purely sponsorship under 343.15. As a sponsor of Courtney's license, he was liable for her conduct. He was her father.
So as I understand it, both individuals now face liability.
That's right.
So if I understand your argument correctly, because of the use of the term applies in the same manner and under the same provisions, since the policy applies coverage to both individuals facing liability, the use of the word applies is substantively different than the use of the word extends, and applies means the same policy applies to each individual.
That's exactly right. And I would add to that the points that I made, that when you look at the purpose behind the omnibus statute and you look at the rule of construction that the legislature does not generate superfluous legislation, and you look at the practical consequences of this. According to general casualties theory, the legislature actually wrote a law that shrinks coverage for the more insureds that you have. If you have two insureds, your coverage shrinks. If you have three insureds, your coverage shrinks. How is that consistent with a policy that's supposed to help people, Wisconsin policyholders and the actively negligent? In addition, it draws a very arbitrary distinction between policyholders and named permissive users. Some permissive users, under their interpretation of 3A, have a full $500,000 in policy limits. Those where the named insured is not involved. Other permissive users have to share their policy limits. Now, is there anything in Wisconsin law or this policy that suggested to Joseph Langer that when he bought $500,000 of insurance coverage, he had to share those limits with somebody else? The limitation of liability clause says that, but then one has to ask, why is general casualty writing a limit of liability clause that is illegal, that has been illegal for 20 years? They make no distinction in their limitation of liability clause between actively negligent policyholders and permissive users and those who are vicariously liable.
But, Counselor, there isn't a case that makes the position that you're taking us to. You want us to extend Miller to apply to vicarious liability as though it were, in fact, a separate act of negligence.
I would state it differently.
Okay.
I would say that the court should reinstitute Miller as the Court of Appeals wrote it, not as it has been interpreted in, and I described the dicta in some elaborate detail, in Mills and Lansinger and Seven Rude and Iaquinta. I would also suggest that Miller is very much consistent with the, what the legislature wrote. The legislature wrote none of this distinction between vicariously liable and actively negligent policyholders and named insureds. All I'm asking the court to do is to interpret the omnibus statute as the legislature wrote it.
You have to overrule any cases to do that, Counselor?
I don't think you have to overrule any cases on the theory that Lansinger, Mills, Folkman, Seven Rood, or Lansinger, Mills, Folkman were all 3B cases. Iaquinta and Seven Rood discussed this active and passive negligence under 3A, but did so in dicta. In neither case was it necessary for the Court of Appeals to reach that, and it was simply passing on what by what I suspect it regarded was now established law. So the short answer to your question is there is no need to overrule a case.
Your opposing counsel asked this question. I think I'll have a mother and a father. They sign the they sponsor the daughter. Under your theory, then there would be three times 500,000. Is that right?
That's right. And that's what the omnibus statute says.
What does coverage mean?
Coverage means policy limits. And the court will find that in the Smith versus National Indemnity case.
So you can read this policy limits extend, or a policy limit extends to any person legally responsible for the use of the motor vehicle. Or if you're under a policy limit provided to the named insured applies in the same manner and under the same provisions to any person using any motor vehicle described therein.
That's what I'm saying.
That's how you want us to read that A.
Because the word coverage is used in A and B, I would suggest that it has no different meaning in either of the statutes. Coverage has always meant policy limits.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Burnett.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Burnett.
Sorry, Justice Prosser.
What would be the practical implications of the court ruling in your favor? How would the insurance companies react?
I would say, if I can spend a few minutes answering that question, there are three things that the court should consider on that. The first is there's been an argument that somehow or other this is going to expand coverage and the underwriting departments are going to have to respond to that. The short answer to that question is that's not the court's concern. That's a legislative concern. And if this court interprets the statute as I've asked it to, the legislature can respond to that or it can accept it. It's very possible that this is what the legislature intended when it passed 3A and 3B because it broke those two statutes down in pieces. The second practical implication is that the court will eliminate the arbitrary distinctions that have characterized Wisconsin law for about 20 years. Some permissive insureds, permissive users will receive the full benefits of a policy while others will receive partial benefits.
But isn't there a consistency here as far as how this court has read policies? I'm talking about the limitations. You're saying that the inconsistency would be there was a consistency under 3B, and that was Folkman, and you say this does not apply. You're trying to go to 3A. But even there, there's been a consistency that we read the policy as a contract, and we read it subject to what 630-232 says, and you're saying that this is an unclear area, therefore we should extend this and give the interpretation you're giving is that because it is not clear, the omnibus statute should control over the contract. That,
I don't think either Mr. Moore or I would disagree that the limit of liability clause forecloses coverage under the circumstance. I say it's illegal.
Sure.
Because of 3A and because it violates Miller versus Amundson, which has been established the law in Wisconsin for 20 years.
You were going to make a third point.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I wanted to get that.
I seem to have lost it. I will see if I can recall it on my reply.
Thank you, Mr. Brady.
It seems to me, I'm not from Green Bay. I'm just from a little town south of Green Bay. As I understand your argument, if there is one sponsor for a minor, then the potential coverage will be twice what the stated limit of liability is. If there are two sponsors, it would be three times.
Not exactly.
I thought that's what you answered, Justice.
I think if your question assumes that the sponsors are married, that would be accurate. In this case, the parents were divorced. If the mom had sponsored the license, she would be covered, but under sub B.
Why is that?
Because she would not be a named insured.
She'd be legally responsible under the sponsorship.
She'd be legally responsible under the sponsorship. And the way many of these policies are written, you really only have one named insured. So it would really be how the agent sets it up.
Wouldn't it actually be three? I'm looking at 343.15 sub 2B, which reads that it's imputed to the parents where both have custody and either parent signed as a sponsor. So it would seem that in situations where the parents were together, and I understand here they're divorced, that the, under your analysis, both parents plus the child would be jointly and severally liable, correct?
That's the correct interpretation of that statute, but I should make clear something I didn't make clear very early. This isn't, 3A doesn't afford coverage to Mr. Langer because he happens to be the sponsor. It doesn't protect him as a sponsor. It protects him as the named insured. That's what the statute says. So if Mr. Langer had taken his car keys.
But he only needs the protection because he's liable, and he's only liable because he's sponsored.
That's right. No, but if Mr. Langer had taken his car keys and given them to his daughter who he knew had three beers, he's liable not necessarily because he's her sponsor, but because he entrusted a vehicle to an intoxicated driver.
Then he's actively negligent.
Pardon?
That's active negligence.
That's active negligence, and he would be covered under Miller versus Amundson in the current state of Wisconsin law, but that coverage that limitation finds no support in 3A.
Your point then is under A, he's covered as the named insured regardless of sponsorship.
That's right. Sponsorship's irrelevant.
All right. And therefore, as the named insured, he's entitled to $500,000 if that was the amount here.
Right.
And then you're saying that coverage, meaning a policy limit, applies in the same manner to any person using the vehicle, and that was the daughter driving.
That's right.
And therefore, he gets coverage as the named insured. She, under your interpretation, she gets covered as the driver.
That's right.
So the bit about active or passive or vicarious liability, as you see it, doesn't come into play here as long as you got that named insured. You would be eliminated under any conditions.
That's my position, yes.
But in the case, you'd say, hey, it comes in under A. Therefore, you don't go to B because you already got it all covered under A.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, we asserted B in this litigation and lost based on Folkman.
Can I follow up the Chief's question, though, because now you just lost me. How do you get to the named insured if there's no liability?
You
know, in other words, you have to have liability before the named insured gets any coverage.
That's right.
So the liability, as I understand it, then kicks you back to 343.15. You can't ignore that from the equation, because once you do that, there's no reason for him to he shouldn't even be a defendant.
I understand what you're saying. The mechanism for liability is the sponsorship statute in this case. The mechanism for liability in my example of a father giving his drunken daughter the car keys is a different one. This statute doesn't focus on the method of mechanism of liability. It focuses on their status, named insureds, permissive users.
But you only get there if there's liability in the first place.
That's right.
They both have to be liable in order for there to be extra coverage.
If I can follow up.
Justice Brasser.
My point is, if I go out and buy an insurance policy with $100,000 of coverage, I pay a certain premium that's charged by the insurer. If I want to triple that coverage to $300,000, I assume my premium's going to go up. And if you're talking now about twice or three times the stated limit in the policy, how does the insurance company address its potential liability?
They increase their premium. And they may well have already. It's well beyond this record, the underwriting considerations General Casualty or any other insurer took into consideration in assessing this premium. But the example that was given in General Casualty's brief went something like this. Two parents sponsor a youthful driver who improvidently gives the car keys to another. Four insureds. Improvidently giving the car keys to another is Aya Quinta. It's already been their liability. How do they take that into consideration? They probably have, because Miller and Aya Quinta have been the law for Miller for 20 years, Aya Quinta for probably 7 or 8. How do they take into consideration their liability for sponsorship? Perhaps they do it in assessing premiums on the youthful driver. Perhaps they do it in another way. I just don't know. And that's why I say that's a legislative concern. That's the kind of thing that a fact-finding hearing would require. And if this imposes an undue burden on an insurance industry, my suspicion is that they'll be chatting with the legislature about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burnett. Mr. Moore, representing General Casualty.
Good afternoon. Greetings of the season. My name is Jim Moore. I represent General Casualty Company of Wisconsin. With all due respect, I'm not sure why we're here, because this very issue was decided by this court 2 years ago in Folkman, the identical issue. I mean the identical issue, in language that can be lifted from that decision and placed into your decision in this case. And ironically, the two lawyers who were responsible for bringing the Folkman case are the same two lawyers who stand before you now in this case, Mr. Burnett and I. Mr. Burnett says that Folkman is different because that was decided under 3B and this case is brought under 3A. That is wrong. You cannot bring this case under 3A. And here's the reason why. If you look at the omnibus statute, it says, and by the way, with all due respect, Justice Abramson, I don't think you get coverage for a named insured because of 3A. You get coverage for a named insured because we have a contract with the named insured. He is the policyholder. We provide him coverage. Our named insured in this case was Joseph Langer, and we provided coverage. Now, Joseph Langer had nothing to do with this accident. He was at home asleep at the time of the accident or watching TV, for all we know. He had nothing to do, so there's no liability. What we do is we get coverage for somebody who's not named in the policy, namely Courtney Langer, under 3A. And we get coverage for Courtney Langer because she was using the automobile. Joseph Langer was not using the automobile. You cannot get the additional $500,000 in coverage for Joseph Langer, as Mr. Burnett wants, under 3A. Take a look at the language of 3A. And it says, coverage provided to the named insured applies in the same manner and under the same provisions to any person using any motor vehicle. That's never been mentioned. They have to be using the motor vehicle. Joseph Langer wasn't using the motor vehicle.
No, but somebody was. Person doesn't say named insured. It refers to a party that's not the named insured.
Correct. Correct. That's how we get coverage for Courtney Langer, who was not a named insured. Well, she was using the motor vehicle.
What about just if A had said, coverage provided to any person using any motor vehicle described?
Sure. Courtney Langer was using it. Joseph Langer was not.
Are you saying that in the statute the words provided to the named insured applies in the same manner and under the same provisions is superfluous?
No, no. It's not superfluous. It means that Courtney Langer gets the same coverage Joseph Langer would have had.
Well, if I can follow up the Chief's question, Mr. Moore, and I want to go back because, for me, I'm trying to follow this very carefully.
Okay.
How does one, under your interpretation, as the father, Joseph, who has been sued in this case, how does Joseph get coverage under 343.15.2b as the parent who is jointly and severally liable with such operation for any damages caused by such negligent or willful misconduct? How does the father obtain insurance coverage for his several liability? Isn't that covered under 3A?
B. He was not using the automobile. He's covered because the omnibus statute says that coverage extends to any person legally responsible for the use of the
automobile. That's under 3B. I'm following the Chief's question.
Right.
Following the Chief's question.
Right. He doesn't get coverage under 3A because he wasn't using the automobile. He would get coverage if he were liable because of our contract with him. But our contract doesn't insure Courtney Langer. The omnibus statute says we also have to cover anybody who's not insured as long as they're using it with the permission of the owner.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, because this coverage shifted over to Courtney,
right,
Mr. Langer's liability under 343.15.2b has no insurance coverage at all.
No,
is that correct?
No, he has coverage under
you just said that's already gone to Courtney.
Sure, but he has the same coverage. He has the same coverage as Courtney does. He just doesn't get another set of liability limits. That's your holding in Folkman. That's the holding in Mills. That's the holding in Lansinger. That's the holding in Severud. There are four cases in the last 20 years that have held the very same thing. You don't, as the sponsor or as someone whose liability is imputed, do not get a separate set of liability limits.
That would be if we interpret his coverage under 3B, correct?
He has no liability in this case. He has no liability in this case except by reason of the sponsorship statute, because he was at home when this happened. So his liability, he's legally responsible for the operation of the, or legally responsible for the use of the motor vehicle.
Also legally liable under the statute. As I'm reading the statute, under 343.15.2b.
He is legally liable, yes, but he wasn't, not for using the automobile. He was not using the automobile. That it says coverage provided to the named insured applies in the same manner under the same provision to any person using any motor vehicle described in the policy. He wasn't using it, so he gets absolutely no coverage under 3A.
You're transposing that sentence to read, coverage is provided to any person using any motor vehicle described in the policy when the use is for the purposes and in the manner described in the policy, and said coverage shall apply in the same manner and under the same provisions as applied to the named insured.
I have to apologize. I didn't follow the
question. Well, what you're reading this as is that A says coverage has to be given to any user, any driver of this car.
Permissive user, correct.
And then the question is how much and when, in what manner, and under what provisions?
It is.
And the answer to that question is the same as the named insured.
Correct. Under the same provisions and in the same manner. So the permissive user.
Named insured is just descriptive there of the kind of coverage you're going to give to the user. That's your interpretation of that.
Well, whatever coverage the named insured would have, the permissive user gets. They don't get any more. They don't get any less.
This protects the user.
This mandates that an insurance company insure the user, the permissive user. Correct.
Mr. Moore, if memory serves me correctly, this policy covered three vehicles?
Four
vehicles.
Correct.
Suppose Courtney was driving a fifth vehicle, a friend's vehicle. The father still has sponsorship liability. How does the policy interact with that?
Well, that's a good question because it would have to be his liability would have to, for coverage to be there under the policy, he would have to be legally responsible for the use of the motor vehicle. And the motor vehicle, I'm going to have to think about this a second, to be honest with you, because would not be insuring that motor vehicle. I don't think the father would get coverage under the general casualty policy because it's not a motor vehicle insured under the policy.
Well, it doesn't say motor vehicle.
I will have to think about that one.
It doesn't say motor vehicle described in the policy, unlike A. A says motor vehicle described in the policy.
Right.
B says coverage extends to the use of the motor vehicle.
Of the motor vehicle.
Yeah, but it doesn't say described in the policy.
No, it doesn't say that, but it talks.
Sometimes the statutes use the when it should be A, or use A when it should be the. So you don't think that you don't think that your policy might cover him at all? I shouldn't talk about the policy. The policy can be broader than the statutes.
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble hearing you today.
Justice Prost's question, in effect, says that where does A or B require coverage of the sponsor of the minor when the minor is driving a non-covered vehicle?
And I believe the answer to that is no.
Okay.
But I'd have to think about that.
I don't know why. And you say it's no because you think B only covers that motor vehicle.
Correct. Because it's a non-insured auto under our policy. I don't hold me to that. I mean, I'd have to sit back and look at it.
But because there may be something in your policy that says insured means also minor residing in the house.
Yeah, because coverage is always triggered by the motor vehicle described in the policy. Liability coverages are.
Except that the named insured driving a rental car is covered ordinarily.
Under my personal policy, if I take a rental car out, I'm covered under my own policy? Not necessarily. You have to get an endorsement for that.
Okay. What if you drive Mr. Burnett's car, if he's willing to, under the circumstances of this case, lend you the car?
I am covered under Mr. Burnett's policy.
Not your own?
Well,
he only has $25,000 because he's not going to give these in policy insurance companies.
I believe I would be covered unless that, and again, you're testing my limits of insurance law as I stand here, but of insurance policy provisions. But I think when I'm driving someone else's car, as long as it's not regularly made available for my use, I think I am covered under my own policy.
I think you are too, but I'm not sure that it comes under A or B, but comes under the terms of your policy.
I think there's a hired and non-owned endorsement that you have to get if you're going to seek coverage under
some other automobile. But now that I think about it, that may apply only in the case where you, where it's regularly made available to you. For example, if my law firm owns a policy and I want coverage under that under my personal policy, I have to get an endorsement because that vehicle is regularly made available to me. I think that's the way how that question is answered.
Okay.
But in any case, and Mr. Burnett concedes that all cases decided under 3B are adverse to him. Mills, Lansinger, Folkman, they're all adverse to him. He cannot get – there's no dispute that we provided coverage to Courtney Langer, that she was using the policy, the automobile with the permission of the owner, and we provided her the same coverage we would have given to Joseph Langer. That is, we gave her $500,000 of coverage, and we offered those policy limits. The question then becomes, do we also cover Joseph Langer, who is admittedly not liable for this accident, but is legally responsible because he's the sponsor? Yes, we do. The coverage that's available to him arises because it arises under 3B. Coverage extends to any person legally responsible for the use of the motor vehicle. And that ends the case, because all the cases under 3B are adverse to Mr. Burnett, and he won't dispute that. Folkman is adverse to him. The extension of coverage to Joseph Langer for his legal responsibility as a sponsor arises under 632.323B. And that is the very question that was answered by this court in Folkman. The violation of Folkman says, therefore, liability coverage was extended to all those legally responsible for the use of the vehicle, and society's obligations were satisfied to the extent of one policy limit payment. That's exactly the holding in Folkman. It was the same fact situation. It was a driver who was under the age of majority, a father who had signed as a sponsor. The question was, does society have to pay one policy limit or two policy limits because the young girl was liable and the father signed as sponsor is legally responsible? One limit or two under the omnibus statute, and this court held exactly as it should hold in this case, that only one limit of liability is payable. You'd have to overrule Folkman to decide in favor of the petitioner in this case. You'd also have to overrule Lansinger and Mills. And by the way, Justice Rogenczak, you're going to have to overrule about seven or eight cases to hold for the petitioner in this case. Mills.
Before I get to overruling all those cases, that sounds like a lot of work. I just want to stay with the statute for a moment. What import, if any, should be given to the words in A when they refer to the motor vehicle? It's motor vehicle described in the policy, and B doesn't have that modifying language with regard to the motor vehicle described in the policy. What import to that difference?
None. It's the same motor vehicle referred to in both sections.
Mm-hmm. I'm exploring the possibility that B is broader, that B would cover sponsorship.
Sure, it does. It covers sponsorship.
But not for a vehicle necessarily named in the policy?
Right.
So are you saying yes, that would be true? That, in other words, if
this statute applies only to the motor vehicle described in the policy because It talks about coverage extends to any person responsible for the use of the motor vehicle being referred to in the previous subsection. And again, if you're asking me whether a standard automobile policy covers sponsorship liability for a non-owned automobile, I don't know the answer.
I'm taking that question and seeing if the difference in the language here can possibly address that question.
Yeah.
That's what I'm exploring.
I apologize. As I stand here, I don't know the answer to that question. But getting back to what I was saying earlier, you're going to have to overrule Lansinger and you're going to have to overrule Mills. Lansinger was the first of those two cases. It was a master-servant case, and the question was, what is the meaning of the term extended? Because in 3B, that's where the coverage gets extended to people like Joseph Langer. Does extended mean that you have to give him the same coverage as you give the permissive user, or is it you have to double and give him additional coverage? And the Court of Appeals in Lansinger says no. As long as they both have the same coverage, you don't double it. In this case, it says Christine's negligence is based solely upon Paul, her servant. When American Family paid $100,000, the policy limits, Christine received the same dollar-for-dollar protection as did Paul for the negligence. The liability of each was satisfied to the extent of that payment. Coverage, therefore, has been extended to both Paul and Christine, the two persons legally responsible for the vehicle, as required by the omnibus statute. You don't have to double it. All you do is extend the same coverage. That's exactly what you said in Folkman. Therefore, liability coverage was extended to all those legally responsible for the use of the vehicle, and society's obligations were satisfied to the extent of a single policy limit payment. That's what the Court of Appeals said in Mills, Mills versus Wisconsin Mutual. It says, because the liability of Robert and Sandra Wintz, the sponsors, based on the imputed negligence of Michael, coverage is extended to them as required by the omnibus statute, as provided by Wisconsin Mutual's policy, which protects them against the liability to the extent of the bodily injury liability limits of its policy.
Counsel, does subsection 5E or 5F have anything to do with this case?
I know the Civil Trial Council of Wisconsin suggests that 5F implicitly says that provisions such as General Casualty has in its policy have been given legislative sanction. I don't read 5F as broadly as they do, to be honest with you. I think 5F refers to a stacking of liability, that a policy can prohibit stacking of liability. But they read it, and they certainly argue that it implicitly implies that the provision in the general casualty policy has been given legislative sanction. And just so we know what we're talking about, that provision in the policy says, and I'm quoting from the general casualty policy, the limit of liability shown in the declarations for each accident is our maximum limit of liability for all damages for bodily injury resulting from any one accident. This is the most we will pay, regardless of the number insureds, claims made, vehicles, or premiums shown in the declarations, or vehicles involved in the auto accident. That's all we're going to pay. And in the case of Mills.
Clear. The question is whether that's okay under the statute.
Well, I don't think I think it's okay because it was upheld in Mills. The Mills case, I don't think it's authorized by the statute. In Mills, Wisconsin Mutual had a policy that says we will pay no more than the limits regardless of the number of vehicles described, insured persons, essentially the same language as general casualty. And the Mills decision says Wisconsin Mutual argues that this clause limiting its liability does not contravene any statute or public policy and is enforceable. And the Court of Appeals said, and I'm quoting, Wisconsin Mutual's limit of liability clause does not therefore conflict with the omnibus coverage statute. It says that policy language in general casualties policy is valid and is enforceable, contrary to what Mr. Burnett's been arguing.
Mr. Moore, if I could, I think I understand the gist of where the disagreement lies, because the argument seems to be going like this.
Oh, sorry.
I think I understand why. Correct me if I'm getting this wrong. The gist of the difference between the two of you is that you are arguing that Joseph Langer's coverage under the statute is limited to sub B, and Mr. Burnett is arguing that he comes in under sub A.
Sure.
And that's the gist of what this case is all about. And depending upon which statute we apply, that's going to kind of govern where this case goes, correct?
Well, I suppose you can look at it that way. You have about seven cases, all of which say that when there's one accident and one negligent party, you only get one limit of liability. I mean, all those cases.
Right,
and however you slice that statute, that's the bottom line holding here.
But as I understand it, all seven cases were under sub B.
Wrong. The Severin case, which is cited in both briefs, and I have my copy of it here, if I can just put my hands on it. Severin talks about 3A, and it says, and in Severin it decided it for a different reason, though. It talks about 3A, and I'll quote it to you, but it decides it because there's only one occurrence. And there's a whole line of cases cited in my brief that says when there's but one occurrence, you still only pay one policy limit. Here's the language from Severud, and I'm reading from paragraph 22 of that decision. It says, although statute 632.323A allowed the plaintiff in Iaquinta to collect twice the bodily injury liability limit, we conclude that Iaquinta is distinguishable, and it's distinguishable because there were two insured's actively negligent. So that's Miller, Amundson, Iaquinta is different. And that says here there is only one negligent insured or additional insured, just as we have in this case. Sonia, according to Iaquinta and 632.323A, do not require that American Family pay twice the bodily injury liability limits. So there, the Court of Appeals says 3A also says you don't pay twice the bodily injury liability limits. So now I argue as a matter of logic that Mr. Burnett's argument is flawed because he says we're bringing this under 3A. You can't bring it under 3A because you're trying to find additional coverage for Joseph Langer, and Joseph Langer was not using the automobile. His liability, if you can find it at all, arises under 3B, or his coverage, I should say, arises under 3B, and all the cases that you've decided and the Court of Appeals has decided that talk about 3B all say if that's the statute, you lose. Because you don't have to extend new limits, you just have to extend the same limits. And but now, if you look at the what case was it, the Severud case, that also says under 3A you don't get two sets of limits.
Is 3B larger than 3A? We discussed that earlier. No. What's the larger? What's the umbrella? Or are they just distinct? Or are they the same?
They're not the same. 3A is the most common one. That's, you know, in terms of larger, that's the one that's most commonly applied. It's whenever a permissive user is driving the car who's not insured. They're still entitled to coverage.
Common isn't my question. Does one subsume the other?
Let me try and answer it this way. 3A is broader in the sense that whoever is driving with permission finds coverage because of 3A. If whoever is driving with permission also happens to be under the age of 18 and is sponsored, or is a servant, then you find additional coverage for the master or the person to whom liability is imputed. So
under, what's the rest of this? That's, you find
it's under the omnibus statute.
Under 3A or 3B, where do you find that?
3B.
That's 3B. What I thought.
But your position would be if the minor, the sponsored party, was not driving one of the insured vehicles, there would be no coverage unless it was found in the text of the policy.
Boy, I wish I knew I was going to be asked this series of questions because I would have gone back and looked at the policy to try and find the answer to that. Let me think about that a second. If we're talking about a minor driving a non-owned automobile, my recollection is, and I could be wrong, I mean, I wish I had taken the time to look through all the sections of the policy dealing with this. My belief is that insurance companies insure automobiles described in the policy, and that people driving those cars, whether the named insured or driving with permission, are insured. And if a person acquires legal liability as a result of someone driving one of those automobiles, even though they may not be driving, then they're also covered for that. I don't know the answer, and I apologize. I just don't know the answer whether a person who has cars described in his policy who may be legally liable for the actions of a child is covered under the policy if the child is driving a car not described in the policy. I just don't know the answer.
Part AA says we will pay damages for bodily injury or I'm reading from page 28 of the appendix, the next brief. It says we will pay damages for bodily injury or property damage for which any insured becomes legally responsible because of an auto accident, and the named insured is shown in a declaration, so it would be the father here who owned the car, the father and the spouse. In fact, the named insured in the general casualty is Joseph Langer. So unless you've got something else in here, when he is liable for bodily injury because of an auto accident, doesn't limit it to the car.
To the named automobile? To describe
the name.
You may be right on that, because as I read this now, insured means you or any family member for the ownership, maintenance, or use of any auto, it says.
Yeah. And I'm...
So you may be right.
You know,
One of our little problems here is the policy can give more than is required under the omnibus statute.
Correct.
And often does.
Right.
The question in this case is, does the policy not give something that is required by the omnibus statute?
Right.
That's what the issue here is.
And it does, at least according to all the prior holdings of this Court and the Court of Appeals. I mean, it does. We've fulfilled all the requirements of the omnibus statute. And Mills, Lansinger, and Folkman all say that.
And insured also in the liability in your policy is you or any family member. Family member means a relative living with you.
Yeah, and I think in this case she was living with her mother, but I can't.
But, as I said, the policy would cover her if she were with her father under this, because she's an insured, even if she's driving another car.
Right.
And that question is it two 500,000s or one 500,000?
It's always one 500,000.
But that's your position. I understand.
That's what the policy says. That's what the contract says.
The question is, the contract valid under the law? Well, and your answer is yes.
Well, not only my answer, the Court of Appeals says it's valid under the law.
If they were right, that maybe one.
I don't disagree with the Court of Appeals, but they.
You're right.
We tend to rely on what you guys say, and Mills says that language is valid and enforceable. And in Folkman, you said it was that's how the outcome is. That it was the same facts in Folkman. And you said only one policy limit is payable. And the omnibus clause was raised there also. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I understand your position, I think, Mr. Moore.
Okay. In addition to the cases I've talked about, Folkman, Mills, Lansinger, and Severud, Justice Rogensack, there are at least four other cases that are cited in the brief that I think hold the same thing. And these are those cases that follow the Severud line of reasoning that when there's but one occurrence, namely one accident, only one policy limit is payable. Severud holds that. Benkert versus Thresherman's Mutual, Smith versus State Farm, Malone versus Gengel, Davidson versus Gasper, all of which are cited in our brief. All of them hold when there's one occurrence, only one policy limit is payable, regardless of how many different theories of liability or whoever might be vicariously liable. Severud is the last of those decisions, but Severud, as Justice Butler asked, uses 632.323a as its basis for holding that. And it isn't, with all due respect to Attorney Burnett, I don't think it is dicta. I think it's a holding in that case. So I think if you're going to say that in the case where one person is actively negligent and one is not negligent at all, that both of them are entitled to separate policy limits, even though there's only one occurrence, and even though the contract language says the most we will pay is one policy limit, and even though that language has been upheld by the Court of Appeals in Mills and by implication upheld in Folkman and in Lansinger and in Severud, I think, with all due respect, you're going to have to overrule a lot of prior decisions.
Or distinguish them.
Right. But it's going to be very hard. The language in those cases could have served as the language for this case. The Folkman language is identical to the facts of this case. The issue that was presented in, is it Lansinger? No, excuse me. I'm not able to put my hand on one of these cases. The issue that was presented is identical to the issue that's presented here. I mean, the precise issue is when you have a child who's negligent and a sponsor who's not negligent, do they get one set of liability limits or two? And all the cases hold one.
Okay. But you're going to make a distinction between active negligence and vicarious liability. Because the same cases that you rely on say if you've got two active negligent tortfeasors, each is fully covered for the entire amount of the policy. So if you had in this case the father in the car with the young woman and the father did something that was negligent, the girl was negligent, the father was negligent, causing injury, you'd be liable for $1 million.
Well, that's Miller versus Amundsen.
Yeah.
But that's not what we have here.
I understand. But what I'm trying to say is you would therefore retain the concept of active negligence, that is an active tortfeasor, versus a vicarious liability. In this case, you'd say is vicarious liability.
Right. I don't think we have to address it because we don't have that. But I'm not advocating you overrule Miller versus Amundsen, no.
You're not, and I just want to clear that up, too, that you agree that where there are allegedly separate acts of negligence, that could result in dual limits?
It could, yes. If there were separate occurrences, it could result in two separate limits being payable.
And so, and it's not almost, in some of the cases, I don't know, maybe one or two of the cases you cited that aren't the main cases here, and I didn't go back and read those, it almost sounded like a but-for test. In other words, the mother may have been negligent, but it wouldn't have made any difference if the daughter were not negligent.
You're right. Those cases, if you read them, say, yes, somebody was negligent in entrusting it, but that's not what caused the injury. It was the driving that caused the injury, and therefore there's one occurrence.
Yeah, but that's not really what we're talking about in terms of the act of negligence. I mean, you're not espousing that for
no,
us.
No, I'm just telling you that's how a lot of those cases come out. They say when there's just one occurrence, then there's only one limit of liability payable.
But
and here, indisputably here, there is only one occurrence.
But you're not hanging your hat on those cases.
No, I'm hanging my hat on Folkman, Lansinger, and Mills, and Severin.
Thank you,
Thank you very much.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Moore. Mr. Burnett.
Okay.
Mr. Burnett, I'm going to ask you to just hold for a moment. We have to change the disc.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to address Mr. Moore's argument in no particular order. He was asked the question of which statute is broader, 3A or 3B. The best way to answer that question is with another question. 3B says coverage extends to any person legally responsible. When is the driver of a vehicle, a permissive user, not legally responsible for it? That statute, if read as general casualty, would have this court read it, covers every case in the universe that will come before this court. There is no need for a 3A if 3B is as broad as general casualty reads it. What general casualty is asking this court to do in a very subtle way is to rewrite the omnibus statute. And what general casualty would have the statute read is this: coverage provided to the named insured extends to any person legally responsible or using the vehicle with permission. That's what general casualty asks this court to hold. It's a far cry from what the legislature wrote. The second thing that general casualty asks this court to do, although it advocates upholding the Miller versus Amundsen active vicariously liable distinction, is to interpret this statute in a way that justifies that distinction in no principled way. General casualty tells this court that this statute, which says coverage provided to the named insured applies in the same manner and under the same provisions to any person using the vehicle, sometimes applies only to some people using the vehicle. Sometimes that permissive user has
$500,000 in policy limits. Sometimes that permissive user has less.
Counselor, how was Joseph using the automobile at the time of the accident?
Joseph was not using the automobile at the time of the accident, and 3A doesn't require that he do that in order for him to have coverage. It says coverage provided to the named insured applies in the same manner and under the same provision to any person using the vehicle.
When the use is for purposes and in the manner described in the policy.
Right. So the question is what is the clause using the motor vehicle describing the policy when the use is for purposes? Who does that refer to? Does it refer to Joseph? Does it refer to the permissive user?
Don't you have to use the automobile to come under A?
No, because the coverage that General Casualty wrote is when the insured becomes legally responsible because of an auto accident.
No, and I'm looking at the statute. I want you to stick with the statute. And his argument is that you cannot bring this claim on Joseph's behalf under A because he was never using the automobile. And that seems really quite a good argument to me. And so I want you to tell me why 3A covers him when he's not using the automobile.
Because it says coverage provided to the named insured. You have to go to the policy to see what coverage is provided to the named insured. It then talks about to any person using. I say using means the permissive user. It doesn't mean the named insured. This policy doesn't say that when if the named insured is using the vehicle and if the permissive user is using the vehicle, then they get separate coverage. And the reason for that is that that makes General Casualty's limit of liability clause all the more illegal.
Let me, if I could follow up Justice Rogenczyk's question, because I'm having the same difficulty. The coverage provided to the named insured.
Right.
That's how you're coming in under 3A. What coverage is provided to Joseph Langer that gets him in the door? What's he covered for?
He is covered for his legal responsibility for an auto accident under the policy. Courtney Langer is covered for her legal responsibility for an auto accident under the policy.
Right, and if I can follow up with that, because doesn't that kind of get back to Mr. Moore's point, that if you say that the coverage is based upon his legal responsibility as opposed to based on his liability under 343.15, if it's based on his legal responsibility, doesn't that put you, Mr. Moore's point is, doesn't that put you in under sub B?
No, it doesn't, because they specifically mentioned coverage provided to the named insured. That can only mean what the policy gives him. The policy also gives the permissive user. Now, Mr. Moore says, well, that just means that they have to share it. All you have to do is look at sub B for that. I say, then, you only need sub B because the named insured and the permissive user are always going to be legally responsible for an accident. So, therefore, this legislature must have meant something different when it passed 3A. And what it meant different is just what the Miller versus Amundsen court held, that the named insured and a permissive user are entitled to separate limits.
And just one last question, because I see your red light is on. Both of you have argued in terms of the negligence, at least the argument is centered around the various negligence of each party and how they come in. Should we be focusing on negligence, or should we be focusing on the liability that each individual has?
I think you should be focusing on the liability because there was only one person who was negligent, and 3A doesn't require negligence. It requires there be coverage under the policy.
But the policy only gives you coverage if there's negligence.
No, the policy gives you coverage if there's legal responsibility.
Yeah.
So even though...
But that puts you back into B, doesn't it?
No, that puts you into the policy. The omnibus statute does three things.
depending on what passage of the statute you look at. 3 says every insurance company has to have these things in their policy. And by the way, general casualty doesn't have either of them in there. Sub 5 says you may have these particular passages in your policy if you want. And the Court's Blaskovic decision, which is cited in Folkman, talks about just what that means. Sub 6 says you may not have these things in your policy, even if you would like to. So when 3A talks about coverage provided, it's talking about modifying an insurance policy. It's talking about modifying a contract. It says a contract that doesn't have these two things in it is against public policy. So if coverage is provided to the named insured, then the permissive user gets that same coverage as a matter of Wisconsin public policy as the legislature has announced it. The legislature also has announced, as a matter of public policy, coverage must be extended, must be shared with anyone who happens to be legally responsible. But if you're the named insured, you're entitled to the coverage you bought.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Burnett. Thank you, Mr. Moore, for your arguments today in this sponsorship insurance case. That concludes our hearing on 03-AP-3258, LeConte v. General Casualty Company of Wisconsin. The Court is in recess until our next oral argument, which is tomorrow at 9:45. We're in recess. Thank you.